Penguin Random House Audio presents Mother Tongue, The Surprising History of Women's Words by Jenny Nuttall. Read for you by Beth Hicks. For my daughter, whom I love more than words. Introduction. Women's Words. As a tutor at the University of Oxford, I teach the history of the English language, as well as Anglo-Saxon and medieval literature. Each term, my students and I explore English in its infancy and adolescence. I love the urgent, need-to-know queries about vocabulary that get fired at me without warning. Often, young feminists want to know more about the history of words relating to women's lives and experience. Does the first syllable of woman come from womb or from another root? One undergraduate asks. Is a maiden always a virgin? Demands another. And is a maiden always a girl? What do spinsters have to do with spinning? How can rape and rapture derive from the same etymological origins? Sometimes I know the answer off the top of my head, but often I have to look things up. And the questions don't stop there. At home, in the last decade or so, bringing up a daughter who is, like so many children, fascinated by the origins and meanings of words, I've answered many queries about names and terms. Now she's a teenager, we search for the right words to tackle trickier topics. What is the best vocabulary with which to talk about the practicalities of puberty? What do I tell her about the myths and realities of love and sex, those new voyages on which she might soon embark, their dreams and their nightmares? In my teaching room, or seated around the kitchen table, I've often turned to my dictionaries for help and encouragement. The history of women's words, it turns out, is full of surprises, of things which aren't necessarily what you'd expect. Even our basics have unfamiliar beginnings. In Old English, the very first version of the language brought to the British Isles by 5th and 6th century migrants, man or mon, as it was then spelled, meant not man or male, but human or person. So mankind was once not quite as default male as it sounds to modern ears. Though the oldest English writings are hard to date precisely, and the survival of texts very patchy, the first illustrative quotation in the Oxford English Dictionary's entry for our modern word man, taken from one of the oldest medical books in English copied at the end of the 10th century, in fact describes a woman being treated for heavy periods. The book advises that a doctor should place horse dung on a hot coal and let it smoke between the thighs so that the person sweats a lot. Not a pleasant-sounding treatment, but rather marvelous that this dictionary's first person is female. Likewise, the etymology of woman itself is not a simple story. Some Renaissance language experts thought its origin must indeed be womb man, with woman meaning that kind of man, i.e. human, that is wombed. So says Richard Verstegen in a 1605 book. But woman, in truth, comes from the Old English compound weefman. You might think that a weefman was a person who is or is destined to be a married woman. A limited patriarchal definition. But that's not exactly right either. Weef and ware in the oldest English mean woman and man, regardless of marital status. So a weefman is a woman human. Scholars have not been able to agree on the etymological roots of that single-syllable weef, something to do with weaving, they speculate, or waving to and fro, perhaps our swaying hips or our busy multitasking, or something about our private parts. No one really knows. As I've been fielding questions at work and at home, I've realized that many of our current words for women's lives and experiences are relative newcomers into English, at least when viewed from the perspective of someone who spends most of her time paddling around in English's very beginnings. While words like wife and man have the deepest roots, many others appear much more recently, inventions of what linguists call modern English, the version of the language which has evolved from the beginning of the 18th century to our present day. But what about the English that came before? The thousand and more years spanning Anglo-Saxon Old English, medieval Middle English, and the early modern English of the 16th and 17th centuries? Was there just radio silence? Gaps and voids of meaning ready and waiting to be filled with words not yet coined? Or did women have useful terms within reach before this more recent set of inventions? There might, I realized, be a lost history of women's words. With the aid of dictionaries and glossaries, I trekked back into the first 1,000 years of the English language, to find the beginnings of women's words, our now-forgotten vocabulary, like an explorer going far inland to locate the origin of some mighty river. There's something perverse, I know, about turning away from a vast flood to find the soggy patch in a field or the unimpressive spring bubbling through a rock which marks its source. But there's a certain satisfaction in knowing a word's history, and a certain magic in finding the very first articulation of a particular idea or experience. There's no need to fall for what linguists call the etymological fallacy, the idea that a word's initial sense or its etymological origins must determine its current meaning. English today is many Englishes, a global ocean system of different varieties and local currents. And when words flow out into their wide oceans, as millions of speakers use and abuse them, their meanings broaden and change. This book will map out some of these evolutions. From time to time, words get lost along the way, and this book rediscovers them too. These early English words for aspects of women's lives have so much to offer us today. It's clear that working women, for example, aren't a recent invention of modernity, but a long-established workforce who are as proud of their labors as we are of our own jobs nowadays. Paying attention to the first vocabularies of caring, motherhood, and maternity shows that these three words are not exact synonyms which demand that all women be maternal and motherly. The histories of words for the ages and stages of female life cycles explain some of the pigeonholes into which society still wants to post us. The origins of the terms we use today for violence targeted at girls and women expose the deep-dug foundations on which perpetrators build their excuses and justifications. But as well as showing us what we're up against in a patriarchal world, these words might also inspire us. Any lingering sense of shame we might feel about menstruation, for example, is dispelled by the past's enthusiastic and fluent discussion of this topic. In old words, we can find surprising new thoughts about our body's capacities for desire, for pregnancy, and for much, much more. These old words might also embolden us to find as many new words as we need to express exactly what we think and feel. And there's nothing to stop us finding fresh purposes for aged terms. As women have slowly made progress towards equality, we've paradoxically lost some of the most expressive and eloquent bits of English vocabulary for describing our lives and experiences. Like vintage tools laid out for sale at a flea market, we can pick up these older words, puzzle out their purposes, compare them with today's language, and see if we have any use for them, decorative or practical. Heading back upstream, this book explores women's words in the English spoken in Anglo-Saxon, medieval, and early modern Britain up to around the year 1800, as well as casting some glimpses overseas as the horizons of this language were expanded through exploration and colonization. My mother tongue's history begins with Old English, the language brought to England's shores in the 400s and 500s by migrants from Germany, Denmark, and the Netherlands, some of whom were from tribes called the Angles or Engles. By the year 600, written records use English to name both some of the people living in England and the language that they spoke. This name, English, gains currency rather quickly, so you might think that other languages like late-spoken Latin and Brittonic were rapidly swept away. Yet the arrival of English didn't bring about wholesale and immediate ethnic and linguistic cleansing. On the ground, there was a mix of cultures and plenty of multilingual speakers for many decades, until English dominated in the 9th century. In this book, I use the modern adjective Anglo-Saxon to describe the people and cultures of England between the arrival of these migrants and the Norman conquest in 1066. But this is a shorthand label for a much more diverse situation. English found its way to dominance amid the fusions brought about by waves of immigration, as well as amalgamation with the native Romano-British population. Over several centuries, English was transformed from immigrant language to a vernacular, the name given to the language spoken by most people in a country as a matter of course, as opposed to languages learned and used for specialized purposes by a smaller elite. When William I and his Norman followers conquered England in 1066, and took over its lands and institutions, English was demoted to a third-class language below Latin and French. It was now the vulgar tongue, from vulgus, Latin for the general public or the common people. Vulgar, as an adjective, first meant commonly understood or widely known, before its meaning gradually grew ever more negative, first unlearned, then ordinary or coarse, and finally rude. This subordination below other languages dramatically.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?